I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Devi Shetty, a cardiac surgeon and founder of the Narayana Rudayalaya Hospital in Bangalore, India. The hospital provides cardiac care for the poor in India, and Dr. Shetty started the hospital in 2001. Welcome, Dr. Shetty.
Thank you very much, Jessica.
I'm speaking with you over the phone. You are currently in your home in India. Could you explain in your own words what Narayana Rudayalaya Hospital does?
The idea is to bring cardiac surgery to everyone. My country requires 2.5 million heart surgeries a year. And currently, we are all the heart hospitals in the country put together only doing about 90,000 heart surgeries. Jessica, first heart surgery was done 100 years ago. 100 years later, only 8% of the world's population can afford heart operation. Something has to be done. Narayana Hrudayalaya Heart Hospital has 1,000 beds, and we have 24 operation theaters. The infrastructure is currently performing about 30 major heart surgeries a day, but that is half of our capacity. And about 30% of our workload is on children coming from 65 countries for heart operation. And about 60% to 70% of the work is adult cardiac surgery.
What is the cost of open heart surgery to somebody who could afford it in India?
Approximately a heart operation on a child who can't afford to pay for the operation would cost about $1,400. The same operation in the U.S. might cost you around $200,000.
What are the primary factors in the business model of low-cost heart surgery? How are you managing to provide low-cost care to India's poor population?
First thing is you have to build a hospital differently. If you build a 100-bed, 200-bed hospital, you cannot reduce the cost. Because in a hospital, bulk of the cost goes for a hard infrastructure like blood bank, laboratories, CT scans, MRIs, PET scans. These are very, very expensive instruments. And what we do is we buy all these advanced machines, but we use them for 24 hours. To run it for 24 hours, you need a large number of outpatients. Large number of outpatients will come, provided you are affordable. So first thing is we build hospitals in about 15 to 25 acres of land. And then we plan to build 5,000 beds, which we build in phases. So if you have large number of beds, then you do more operations. As you do more operations, your results get better. As your results get better, your cost also goes down. And because of these two reasons, more people will come to you.
What were you doing prior to opening the hospital?
I graduated from a medical college called Kasturba Medical College in Manipal, Mangalore in India. Then, like most Indian doctors, I went to England for training in cardiac surgery. Then I came back to Calcutta. I was one of the first few heart surgeons to come back to India to set up cardiac surgical unit. It was in 1989, where cardiac surgery was a mystery to most of my citizens. And when I started my career in Calcutta, if I saw 100 patients per day, not even one person could afford the heart operation. Then I realized that unless I take care of the ability to pay or the paying capacity of the patient, I wouldn't have a practice. So this is how everything started.
You conducted surgery on Mother Teresa. How was that a turning point for you, if at all?
Meeting Mother, as a scientist, I would never accept another human being with flesh and blood like me as God. But I can tell you that Mother was truly God in human form. Being with her, interacting with her, maybe as a heart surgeon treating her, it was a turning point in my career. Her simplicity, her approach towards the realities of life, it made a tremendous impact. And she gave me the fantastic definition of the definition for a pediatric cardiac surgeon. One day I was going for rounds and she was following me, even though she was an inpatient. She looked at the kids I operated. Then she looked at my eyes and she said, "Doc, I know why you're here." I said, "Why, mother, why am I here?" He said, "When God made these children with the heart disease, he was probably preoccupied. Then he realized there was a problem and he sent you to fix it." And that is the best definition one could give for a pediatric cardiac surgeon.
How religious were you prior to meeting Mother Teresa?
I was always religious, no, undoubtedly. I was born and brought up in a typical Hindu family down south, where religion is part of our life. But she reinforced my belief in God. She convinced me that the best way to serve God is by serving mankind. So I still have a poster of Mother Teresa in my office, which says, "Hands which help are better than the lips that pray."
And Narayana Rudayalaya, the name of your hospital, means God's compassionate home.
Essentially, in India, primarily we revolve our life around God and the cosmic forces. We wanted to create something unique, something big, which would make a difference to the society. Rudaya is heart. Alaya is temple.
We talk about Mother Teresa having this seminal impact on you, but was the train on the tracks to create this hospital even prior to your meeting her?
I think I was in the process of thinking about doing something different, something big. And this interaction with Mother, which lasted for close to 5 years, definitely had an impact on where I wanted to reach. Definitely it had a big impact in terms of looking after the underprivileged are the main concern and the pivotal role it had in building this institution.
My guest is the medical entrepreneur, Dr. Devi Shetty. Dr. Shetty is a cardiac surgeon who pioneered low-cost cardiac surgery for India's poor population. He now provides heart care, eye care, orthopedic care, and cancer care to patients in India who cannot afford health care otherwise. Now, the institution or the hospital is in Bangalore, India, and Bangalore is known as sort of the Silicon Valley of India, where there's a lot of technical innovation. Why did you choose to locate the hospital in Bangalore? Was it accidental or was it purposeful?
My wife is from Bangalore. That is one of the main attractions to come back to Bangalore. But, you know, it's a coincidence that Bangalore happens to be the Silicon Valley and so many exciting developments are happening in Bangalore. That definitely helped our objective. But the decision to come back to Bangalore was coming back home.
You mentioned your wife, and it was your in-laws who funded the project. What did your mother or father-in-law do that enabled them to have enough capital to fund the hospital?
My father-in-law was running a very successful construction company, in fact, around 20 years ago. So towards the end of his professional life, he wanted to build a hospital to make a difference to the society. But he had only one condition, a condition that we should never refuse any child who comes to us with a heart disease, irrespective of caste, creed, and nationality. And this is something which he firmly believed, and he insisted that we do it. That's the only condition he had. And we carried on, and this is how the whole thing started.
It seems, Dr. Shetty, that there was this real kind of perfect intersection of Mother Teresa and your medical expertise and your father-in-law all coming together to create this hospital. Do you ever think about that, kind of the stars aligning?
You're right. I strongly believe in that, Jessica. I strongly believe in cosmic forces. Long, long ago, Jessica, I received a donation of 100,000 rupees from one of the army soldiers from Madras. He refused to give his name, and he wrote one note saying that the path you have chosen, the amount of money I am giving is too small. But God has his own mysterious ways of doing the rest. This is exactly what happened in my life. These are all strange coincidences at every level of my life. But I strongly believe that there is somebody up there with the proper design, which is a mystery to me. Mm-hmm. And that's what keeps happening all the time.
So you decide to launch this initiative in Bangalore. How did you get the land to build this vast health campus?
Our country is made up of 32 states, and these states have chief ministers and the government. And these governments are very supportive of hospital projects by people like us. So we get land virtually free, or we get land for a token amount of money, because government wants this type of large initiatives to come up.
Your hospital is performing roughly 7,000 surgeries a year, and often your doctors are being paid less than doctors elsewhere in the country. How is morale among your doctors?
We have zero attrition rate. No doctor has ever left us. I guess there is not even only one person left in the last 15 years for family reasons. Now, why people stick around, even though their salary is not up to the level what they can get elsewhere, is because as surgeons, if you want to attract them, they need much more than money. They want to do something else. And we always provide what they want, because I am one among them. Every day, children come to us. You know, typically a newborn baby who's very, very blue comes to you. We look at the kid, we tell the mother, baby requires operation. The baby goes to the OT, comes back to the ICU, and we call the mother to see the baby after 4 hours. Mother looks at the baby and say, look, this is not my child. Then we say, that is your child. Then the mother says, look, he was dark, he was black before you did the operation. Then we tell her that, yeah, he was dark, but now he's pink. Then she will touch the baby, and then she will look at our eyes and say, will he always remain like this? Then we say, yeah, he's going to remain like that. So in a matter of 5 hours, we have transformed the lives of these people. So this is something which you can never buy, irrespective of what money, you know, what you're prepared to trade.
You mentioned before that 30% of the surgeries that you conduct in your hospital is for babies or pediatric care. Why is it so high? Is it larger in India than in other countries?
Jessica, you remember, we produce 28 million babies a year. We produce the largest number of babies in the world. One out of 140 children born anywhere in the world has heart disease. That means technically we produce about 600 to 1,000 children a day with heart disease. And someone has to fix their heart, because these children, if they are operated the moment they are born or in the first few months of their life, you can cure them. So someone has to do it. So we are privileged to be that someone to fix these children's heart.
I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Devi Shetty, a medical entrepreneur who's creating a new healthcare economic model in India by providing affordable cardiac care for India's poor population. We'll hear more from Dr. Devi Shetty coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is the medical entrepreneur Dr. Devi Shetty, a cardiac surgeon who pioneered low-cost cardiac surgery for India's poor population. Over 7,000 surgeries take place in his Nayanarayana Hrudayalaya Hospital, located in Bangalore, India. Dr. Shetty founded the hospital in 2001. Now, you offer a form of insurance called Yashasvini. Can you talk a little bit about the germ of the idea for providing insurance?
The Karnataka Milk Federation, which is a conglomeration of milk producers, they requested me to sponsor one of their low-fat milk, claiming that it's good for the heart. And I agreed to endorse their product, provided the Milk Federation agrees to offer health insurance to the people who sell milk. So they agreed to do that. This is how we started the micro health insurance for the people, farmers who sell milk. And it started with a premium of 11 cents per month. We kept the premium at 11 cents because that is the price of local cigarette called BD they smoke. So the idea was to promote this concept that instead of smoking BD, you buy a health insurance and you will be protected for major illnesses. Today it has grown. This insurance has now spread to other states of the country. Everywhere, 60%, 80% of state population is covered by the health insurance.
So this health insurance that you offer started with this milk cooperative, essentially this group of farmers who, as you say, pay 11 cents a month for insurance. Can you talk a little bit about the rural poor? I mean, your hospital is in Bangalore, in a major city, but how are you addressing the needs of the rural poor who can't be transported to the hospital in time if they're having a heart attack, for example?
First thing is, when they develop heart attack, we look after their heart attack from remote areas, from the satellite. We have, you know, Jessica, there are 5 countries in the world which can put satellite on the space, and India is one of those countries. And we have been chosen to be partners with the Indian Space Research Organization to help them to monitor the astronauts when India eventually puts the man on the moon. And we have satellite connection free of cost. So we put up these satellite collection in remote government hospitals and manage heart attack and heart failure sitting in Bangalore or Calcutta. And till date, we have treated over 53,000 heart patients in remote location.
Can you walk me through, let's say Devi the farmer is having a heart attack or is having some heart trouble. Can you walk me through what happens to him?
Yeah, let's put it this way. A farmer in Hubli, which is about 300 kilometers from Bangalore, if he develops a heart attack, he will go to a general practitioner with chest pain. And most general practitioners down south has a ECG machine, which is linked to the telephone line. And as soon as he does the ECG, it comes to our hospital. And in less than 5 minutes, we give the report to the telephone line. And if it is diagnosed as heart attack, we ask them to go to a coronary care unit in a government hospital or one of our satellite units over there. So the preliminary care is taken care of. That will save about 95% of the victims of heart attack. And after about 1 month, they will come to Bangalore for further evaluation. And there we do the angiogram and, if required, operation.
You mentioned the Indian Space Research Organization that helps you use satellites for this cardiac care. Whose idea was it to use this space research organization?
The Indian Space Research Organization, they wanted us to help them in monitoring the vitals of astronauts. So we are helping them in their project, and they help us to give the satellite connections free of cost. Right now, sitting in Bangalore, we treat patients in 56 cities of Africa where our satellites are beamed. But the exciting thing, Jessica, I'll tell you, when we do liver transplants on children in Bangalore, do you know who gives the anesthesia for the kids? The anesthesia is given by Children's Hospital of Philadelphia in America.
Wait, so can you explain that to me, how a hospital in Philadelphia is helping you with a liver transplant in Bangalore?
We have extremely skilled surgeons who can do the liver transplant. But our anesthetists are cardiac anesthetists. They do not know the details about managing very sick child who is undergoing a liver transplant, where the operation lasts for 10 hours, 12 hours. So we tied up with Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. The anesthetists there, they realize that since we have the satellite link up, they can sit in the operating room of Philadelphia and manage the anesthesia of the kid who's undergoing operation in Bangalore. Other than touching, they can do everything.
So we talk about, Dr. Shetty, you're creating a health city, but it sounds, with this example of the connection with Philadelphia and also serving African patients, that essentially you're creating a health world.
Trying to, Jessica.
My guest is Dr. Devi Shetty, a cardiac surgeon and founder of the Narayana Rudayalaya Hospital in Bangalore, India. The hospital started off serving cardiac care for India's poor, and now its health centers help patients who have heart problems, eye problems, arthropedic issues, and cancer as well. Could you provide some anecdotes to help us understand what you do on a daily basis?
I start my work very early in the morning, generally, my colleagues start the surgery at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I reach the hospital by around 7:30. Then I have to see at least 70 to 100 patients every day in the outpatients. That's the time patients come, they talk to me about their problems, I console them, try to organize financial assistance. And the, essentially, it's like a sort of a meeting area for the patients. I spend about 5 hours with the patients. Then around 12 o'clock, I start the surgery. And I generally concentrate on operations called pulmonary endarterectomies or aneurysms. This is my area of interest. And sometimes I operate on newborn babies. Then as soon as I finish the operation, then maybe half an hour or an hour with my team discussing about various strategies and management issues. Then again, the outpatient. And then it's around 9:30, 10 o'clock. That's the time to go home.
You mentioned you see 70 to 100 patients per day in a span of 5 hours?
Yes. I generally try to spend about 2 to 3 minutes with each patient. Everything has been done by my colleagues. The diagnosis is made, the planning was made, everything is done. But most of these people, unless I see them and unless I touch them, they wouldn't like to go for the operation. Mm. So it is essentially getting to know the family and explain to them that this is what we are planning to do. It is just reassurance that I am there to help them. I try to see at least in 5 minutes, about 2 patients. Mm-hmm. I have a very big clock hung in front of the wall so that I'm constantly reminded. And I have a very fancy chair made by Herman Miller, which can move from one end of the table to the other end like a Ziffy. So I can turn my chair on and off and, you know, facing one patient, and the second minute I'm facing another patient.
Incidentally, was the Herman Miller chair donated?
That's a good question. It is actually gifted by my son. When he graduated, I guess he earned some money, and he was looking at me struggling with the old Indian chair where the wheels used to get stuck up. You see, what happens when I talk to a patient, the first 2 minutes is about talking to the patient, getting to, you know, convincing them about the treatment and all that. Then they are happy with the treatment. Then they start talking about, you know, I operated on their uncle or a father or a grandfather, how well he is or how grateful I am and all that. That's the time I try to move my chair to the other side of the table. Mm. And I need very good wheels. And my son realized that Herman Miller is the best chair.
So really what you're giving to these, you know, 100 patients is emotional consultation versus medical consultation.
Perfect. Yeah, you got it right, Jessica.
Do you worry at all that there's this kind of Walmartization of healthcare? In order for your hospital or for your low-cost health plan to work, you really have to serve many, many, many patients. You know, as you say, you're seeing 100 patients a day. You're doing 2 operations a day. This is obviously far more than the international average. Do you ever worry about the optics of that?
Not really. In the sense, see, there are a lot of changes happening in the country. Now, people, when they come to us, they're a lot more knowledgeable about what we are doing in the heart operation. So they have less questions. They are mentally prepared when they come. And also, my team is growing. So I'm surrounded by physician assistants and well-trained doctors. So essentially, I wouldn't say that as the workload goes up, we lose touch with the patients and the emotional aspect of it. I don't think it will happen. Mm. I think it's only getting better as the time passed by.
You talk about being at work around 7 in the morning and going home around 10 at night. What does your wife think about this?
She was finding it. She comes from a very rich family. So, she was initially a bit disappointed. But then, you know, as the family grew, now my children are grown up. My oldest son is an engineer. He's building all the hospitals. And my second son is a doctor, third son is in the medical school. She kind of likes my profession, even though she doesn't admit. all along she cursed my profession. But when my oldest son decided to become an engineer, and one day he declared that, "Daddy, I want to become an engineer." I said, "All right, that's good." Then she just, the hell broke loose. And I said, "What happened?" She said, "Why he doesn't want to become a doctor?" Then I said, "All along you have been cursing my profession, and you're disappointed your son doesn't want to become a doctor." That's the time I realized maybe my wife likes my profession.
My guest is the medical entrepreneur, Dr. Devi Shetty. Dr. Shetty is a cardiac surgeon who pioneered low-cost cardiac surgery for India's poor population. He now provides heart care, eye care, orthopedic care, and cancer care to patients in India who cannot afford health care otherwise. Dr. Shetty, your public health initiative has been quite successful against many odds. Could you talk about some of those odds or hurdles that you had to jump over in order to provide low-cost health care to the poor population in India?
When I started my career, the greatest difficulty was convincing people to undergo the operation. The heart surgery was in the infantile stage. Then once I accomplished it, the problem was the affordability.
You have this vision of having 30,000 beds in your health center. What are the hurdles to making that happen? Are they financial? Are they getting people's imaginations to understand what that means? What are those hurdles?
See, the first thing is we strongly believe that India will become the first country in the world to dissociate healthcare from affluence, healthcare from your bank balance. If there is one country in the world which can do it, that is India, because we produce the largest number of doctors, nurses, and medical technicians in the world. Mm-hmm. We have the largest number of US FDA-approved drug manufacturing units outside USA. We have everything required for a fantastic healthcare delivery system. But there is something which can prevent this from happening, that is lack of adequate beds. That is the reason why we want to create these 30,000 beds. Our biggest stumbling block now is arranging funds at our terms to roll out this many beds in a short duration of time without really losing control of the organization. This has been the challenge, because regular financial mechanisms will not be able to help us. So the challenge is raising equity, raising money for all this massive scale expansion.
What is your annual budget?
I guess around $100 to $120 million.
Per year. Yeah. It costs about $200,000 for a patient in the United States to have open heart surgery. And you are building a center or a hospital, a cardiac care center, in the Cayman Islands so that United States citizens and those nearby could benefit from low-cost surgery. Why does it cost $200,000 in the U.S.?
I think in the U.S., the cost structure is radically different. You see, we work for 6 days in a week, whereas in the U.S., it's only 5 days in a week. Plus, your nurses and doctors generally work for 48 hours in a week, whereas we work virtually double the number of hours. So in U.S. hospitals, traditionally 65% of the revenue goes for the salaries, while in Indian hospitals it's about 20%. So essentially the cost structure, the litigation, the malpractice suits, these are all issues which would jack up the price. And also there is large insurance companies, you know, with their own, agenda. So essentially, it is a business where there are too many people with too many rigid rules and regulations, and there is absolutely no scope for innovation in the process of delivery. You just cannot innovate.
Hopefully, now that you'll be setting up a center in the Cayman Islands, some competition will cause the U.S. to get their butts in gear.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I don't think I would like to compete with the American hospitals. I just want to show our modest way of doing things.
You mentioned malpractice and lawsuits in the United States. How common are medical malpractice lawsuits in India?
It's extremely, extremely small. Primarily because as surgeons, we spend a lot of time with the patient before operation. We make things very clear to the family. So they don't have unrealistic expectations.
Doctor, you've changed so many people's lives. You've improved so many people's lives by providing low-cost cardiac care. Is there a story or two that come to your mind to demonstrate this?
See, essentially, I am like anybody else in the patient community because as a kid, I am the eighth child of a family with nine children. So when I grew up, my parents were old. My vivid memories about my father is an elderly person who goes in and out of the hospital because of diabetes complications. So in my life, doctors remained as very important people, and this may be one of the reasons why I decided to become a doctor. So when I interact with the patients, when I see a young lady with a young husband undergoing heart operation with young children, when I operate on them, I think about my life. In case my father had an operation, needed an operation when he was young, and if something happened to him, we would all be on the street. So, you know, these patients' lives are no different than our life. I guess this is one of the greatest motivating factors for all of us to do our best to save their life.
Well, Dr. Shetty, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Jessica. It was a great experience talking to you because you are the first Western interviewer who could pronounce the name of my hospital.
My guest has been Dr. Devi Shetty, a cardiac surgeon who pioneered low-cost cardiac surgery for India's poor population.
Coming up, we'll meet the painter Stephen Hanick. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Stephen McDonnell, the founder of Applegate Farms. Applegate is a natural organic meat company that has been part of the natural meat movement since the early 1980s. The company's meat is sold in delis and natural food stores like Whole Foods and Trader Joe's across the United States. Stephen started Applegate when he was 32, and he used to be a vegetarian until he sold a healthy meat that even he would eat. Applegate supports over 200 family farms who are dedicated to the humane treatment of animals. Welcome. Stephen, before we go into the history of Applegate Farms, I'd like to know exactly what Applegate Farms is.
Applegate Farms is a natural foods meat company that provides about 130 different products, meat products, all cooked or processed, as we call it, bacons, hot dogs, deli meats, chicken pot pies, nuggets, items like that.
I want to understand what led you to this point, and I'm wondering what you were doing before you founded Applegate, which you founded when you were 32 years old.
Right before getting into Applegate, I was working for my brother-in-law, who is an Irish glassblower named Simon Pierce, who's got a small glassblowing business in Vermont. And I had been a management consultant in Boston, getting bored with all the kind of theoretical, wonderful ideas, but couldn't get my hands into anything. And this was 1986, at the point that his business was taking off and needed some support. So I went to work for him and just fell in love with the small business environment. At that point, I knew that I needed to do something on that level, which ultimately led me to Applegate.
You were working for Simon for how long?
I worked for him for about 2 years.
How come you didn't continue working with him?
Well, I left that because when I got in there, we started to turn things around, and I looked at this business, and I said, Simon, you're my brother-in-law. He's married to my oldest sister, Pia. And I said, Simon, you've got to cut me in on this. I'm your brother-in-law. And he thought about it, and the day I asked him, he was lying flat on his back with his back going out. And, of course, I chose that perfect moment to walk into his office. He's lying horizontal on the floor to propose this idea that he cut me in on his business, which he had started in the early 1970s. So he in his very typical charming Irish way, said, let me think about it, and came back a couple of weeks later and said, no, I don't think that's a good idea for you or for me. Of course, I was completely stunned that he wouldn't want me there. In retrospect, that's the best thing that ever happened to me because it forced me out to go get on, you know, find something on my own.
Right. And so did you say, okay, fine, if you're not going to make me part of the management, I'm leaving. Was it that sort of vitriolic?
Oh, yeah, no. And it was obvious to him when he said it that we could no longer continue because I really crossed the equity line. And when you cross the equity line, you're in with both feet or out with both feet.
What did you do from there? You're like, okay, I'm no longer working for Simon Pierce and I am now just going to go start a meat company? Or
no,
how did that happen?
As I said, before Simon, I'd done the management consulting. At that point, I was so frightened. I knew that I wanted to be an entrepreneur, and everything that I had done had led me to that point, but it's still obviously a very scary step. So I immediately tried to retreat back into management consulting and had these interviews with these management consulting firms who in the first 5 minutes said, Steve, you do not want to go back into consulting. You need to go out and do something on your own. So I just started looking for a business and ran into a friend at a New Year's Eve party who told me about a business that he was looking at and said, well, we can do it together. So I went and looked at this company called Jugtown Mountain Smokehouse, which was the original name. And it was a small, you know, 5,000 square foot smoked meat facility. And I said, Chris, this thing is too small. Either you do it or I'll do it. So he called back a couple of weeks later and said, I'm not going to do it if you're not going to do it. And so I kind of jumped in.
You mentioned that you were entrepreneurial, like you just felt that you had it in your blood. How did you know?
Well, having struggled through school and been in a lot of academic environments where I wasn't motivated or excited, I always knew. I was the kid that, you know, in high school they said, well, you just got to wait till the guy gets to college before he does something. And then I go to college and they said, well, you're just going to have to wait till after college. So it was in the small business environment that I felt like my brain woke up. What I say to people is my IQ goes up and down in direct proportion to how close my butt is next to a fire. So if I'm at high risk, I get very smart. As soon as I start working for somebody else and it's not mine, I just don't have the same mental acumen or focus or interest to solve problems, to try things, and my creativity just kind of goes down if it's not mine.
Did you have any influence from your mother or father in the business world at all? What did they do?
My mother was taking care of 9 kids, and my father was an investment banker, you know, in New York. Neither of them had direct entrepreneurial experience. I think my father taught me how to reach out and connect with people, networking. My mother was more of the one who taught me that I could do it. And she, if she was, you know, 30 years old now moving into a career, there isn't a company in America that she couldn't run well. And even though she wasn't in the business environment, she taught all those principles of focus and will and desire about, you know, getting whatever it is you want to do.
So moving from your family life to this natural meat company, how did it then go from Jugtown to Applegate Farms?
Well, we were doing nitrate-free product and product that was not using phosphates or, you know, adding water to the product. So we were in a very high-quality product, but we hadn't migrated yet to antibiotic-free or organic meat. So the business started to grow, and we had these old gravity pit smokehouses, which are just the old-style smokehouses, which had been there for years. And we got those smokehouses going so fast and running so often that we basically lit 2,000 pounds of bacon on fire one night when it was smoking overnight, and the whole back end of the business burnt down. So those are one of those seminal moments when you think the world's coming to an end after you've worked so hard. In 3 weeks, we had that back up and running, and this is with USDA inspections and controls. But in the interim, we had to tell our customers to go to our competitors to get product. And we had to go to our competitors to have the stuff we needed made in the interim. So all of a sudden, we started getting these shipments in from our competitors or different people. And we're like, well, this stuff's better than what we do. And at that moment, I kind of realized there was tons of production facilities doing smoked meats and other type of meat. What there really wasn't was a brand out there that was dedicated to focusing on producing healthy organic or natural meat that was focused on the consumer.
So it was all by accident, in a way, that you discovered that you wanted to be in the natural organic meat business as a result of your smokehouse burning down and getting the meats from your competitors.
Everything we've done, we've learned by mistake or as an accident. The percentage that we knew what we were going to do when we grew up and actually executed to that level, the day-to-day is all 90% stumbling.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Stephen McDonald, the founder of Applegate Farms, a natural organic meat company that sells products to Whole Foods and other natural food stores around the United States. Walk me through the life of a cow in your company. Let's say you're a cow in Uruguay. How does it end up on my dinner plate in New York?
When you say no antibiotics, you're basically saying they'll never be sick, which means you have to completely change the way that you treat them. The difference between organic meat and antibiotic meat is they're raised exactly the same way. One is fed organic grain, certified organic grain, and the other one is not. But in all cases, you never use antibiotics, and you're never using animal byproducts. So the analogy I use is if you've got children, if your kids are going to go to a daycare center, and you are going to say you will never give those kids any antibiotics if they get sick, there are a couple of things you're going to do differently. You're going to make sure you feed the kid very well because you don't have the backup of giving an antibiotic. So nutritionally, you're going to focus. And in this case, it means not using animal byproducts, which are cheap meats, but very good grains. You're also going to house them differently. So you want them to have access to fresh air. You want them to have sunlight. You want them to exercise. They need room to exercise. And so the physical environment is much more attuned to supporting the immune system and building the immune system of each of the animals. And then the third piece of it is sanitation and control. So what needs to happen, these barns need to rest. So every once in a while, you have no birds or animals if they're in houses and let the natural process of germs disinfect itself and then restore it. If you try to cram the animals up too tightly and accelerate their growth with hormones or steroids, feed them lousy feed, you're going to get systemic diseases. On the humane issue, what we feel is that these animals ultimately are dedicating themselves to becoming food for humans. And our responsibility is to honor that process, respect those animals, and give them disease-free environments that are healthy and ones in which their immune systems can support their growth.
So they go from this life of luxury to the slaughterhouse in, let's say, Uruguay. And then, right. Then what happens?
Then what happens is we will take whatever we're making, if we're making roast beef or we're making beef hot dogs or whatever, we'll send the appropriate meat to the different processors who then receive our raw material, and then they have strict quality control standards. They can only run this product first because you can't be running commercial product and then our stuff without doing a whole sanitation process in the interim. So we're usually brought in, and we can take the date code of a product that you buy in the store, and we can trace it back to the lot that it was made at the processor. We can also trace it back to the lot when that animal was slaughtered, and we can also trace it back then to the farms. So traceability is a very important issue for our consumers and for us to know what we're actually receiving at the end of the day.
So take me back to the very beginning. Before your smokehouse burnt down, how did you fund it initially? Did you have outside capital or was it all your own?
I closed in July of 1987, which was right before the October crash, mm-hmm. stock market crash. I went to a bank who ended up loaning me 120% of the purchase price. So I had $35,000 left over in my bank account, which I was able to use to start buying inventory and paying payroll. And so as it turned out, I never put a dollar of my own or anybody else's into the business.
And why were they willing to lend you money?
I had a local banker, this old street guy named Bill Purcell, who, you know, basically loaned money to gas stations and small grocery stores. I went back to him, and you know, several years later, I go, "Why did you do that?" Because, you know, of course, after the 90s and the whole, you know, banking issues, everything now is loaned on ratios, and a banker has no leeway to kind of, you know, give the money that they want just because they like you. He turned to me and he said, "I know you're going to be successful." And he went out on a flyer, and that's what got me started. And when I go meet now these big bankers who want to helped me grow my business, I always try to remind him of that guy who, you know, never made it into the big banking world, but was, for an entrepreneur, exactly what you need to get started.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Stephen McDonnell, the founder of Applegate Farms, a natural organic meat company that sells products to Whole Foods and other natural food stores around the United States. We've been talking about the early days of the business, and I'd like to know how you went about selling the product to customers initially.
The story that I remember most in the early days was my uncle, who was an investment banker in New York, had sold A&P to a German company. And so I was like, great. Well, you know, I called him up and said, can you get me a meeting with this, you know, with A&P? They're a huge chain, you know, here in the East. And he said, sure. So he called up the president, who then got me a meeting with the meat buyer. So I go traipsing into the meat buyer and sit down and say, hi, I'm Steve McDonnell, you know, my uncle, blah, blah, blah. And I, like an idiot, told him, you know, where, how I had gotten to him. And he turned to me before the meeting had started and he stopped me and he goes, listen, son, if you think that I am ever, or this chain will ever, buy a single pound of your product because you came from the president of the company, you are sorely mistaken. Now, I have one piece of advice for you. Pick up your stuff and get out and don't ever come back. And it's true now as it was then. In the meat business, you work yourself up the ladder. You go in the ground floor and you earn your stripes. And that was a great lesson, although it was kind of shocking at the time.
You've been humbled by this A&P experience. So do you now just call the founder of Whole Foods, or do you get in through the butcher, through the meat department?
We were just starting out. They were just starting out. We were kind of like minds and just became kind of friends. And they started requesting meat that was raised without any antibiotics at all. So then we started to go out and find farmers and set up growing systems that raise those animals without antibiotics.
I want to turn to your initial partner, Chris Ely, whose father had owned the smokehouse that you acquired. And I was wondering if there are any partner issues between you and Chris.
The reason this company happened in large part was because of how easy that relationship has been. He allowed me from day one to be in control and totally saw that I was a vehicle for him because he didn't have the background I had to help this company realize its dream. So doesn't mean we don't go at it on several occasions. There was never a point where we came to, had discussions saying we're not going to work together. It's just been a wonderful, easy relationship, and I know how rare that is to find.
And it's partly easier because he relinquished control to you and he didn't have an ego about that, because you do like to be in control.
No, that's true. And he saw that and very wisely stayed away from it. He, like me, is married to a very strong woman. So both of us, you know our boundaries in certain areas, and we figured that out pretty early
on. So you're
on.
Humbled at home, but at the workplace, you like to stretch your arms a little more.
I'm way humbled at home, and I'm often humbled in the workplace, but I can kind of push back a little bit more in the workplace.
And so your wife, what's her name?
Jill Carney.
She was there throughout the growing years of the business.
She was there and never was her gift to me. Her father's a sculptor. So what she brought to me was an understanding of small business and a love of small business. And she was in the movie business, so she was in a very stylish, fancy business with lots of attention and distractions. And here she was living in Los Angeles at the time. She would fly back east to hook up with this guy who had this small smoked meat company in New Jersey. And none of her friends in Los Angeles could understand what that was about. What that was about for her was getting back to her father being a sculptor and being working with his hands and working in a real environment. So that support, knowing that I was okay, because when I bought the business, I was so nervous about doing it and so unsure about what I was doing. I didn't tell any of my friends. I just did it. And that validation was very important. She now is getting much more involved in the company and helps out on the text on the back of the boxes are all her words. And she is a writer, and she has a way of writing our message that I think keys into our consumers far better than anybody else I've seen.
We're getting to the current stage of the company, and I want to ask you how your role has changed from the very, very early days of getting this off the ground to now a manager of how many people?
We've got about 65.
So how are you as a manager in addition to being an entrepreneur?
Well, I'm great, but you'd have to ask the employees to get the honest opinion.
Well, what would they say?
I've had a lot of employees work for me for a long period of time, and I've only lost one employee, someone who was in customer service, who I didn't really want to lose. I feel that ultimately I need to hire a number two.
And you're not threatened by that at all?
I'm totally threatened by that. I think I have way too much of my identity wrapped up in this company, which is what I've been doing nonstop. I think as the company gets bigger, to have the owner and founder that wrapped up in the business is not healthy.
And do you have advisors telling you that, or are you internally recognizing that yourself?
I don't have a board of directors, and everybody's telling me I need to, and I will eventually do that. You know, this is more from an internal reflection than it is other people. The business is going very quickly through its teenage phase. And so if you have been a entrepreneur for 18 years like I have, it's like raising your children up into the teenage years and realizing that you can't be a shrink to your own teenage child, that at some point somebody else needs to step in and do that. And there's a function there. Doesn't mean you're going to stop being the parent. You're always going to be the parent. But the child needs more than just the mom or the dad around. And so it's kind of coming into that realization.
Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Stephen McDonald, the founder of Applegate Farms. To learn more about the show, visit our website at fromscratchradio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.